Okay, welcome back. Welcome back to the second half. It's good to be here. Some of you here will know that I had been here in the past for a long time. I was just thinking during the tea break there that I was probably here when we started doing Sangha mornings, class. I don't think we called it that in those days. It was just someone hit upon the idea why don't we do a class on Saturday morning? But lo and behold, it proved to be a very popular time for a session, and we've done them kind of every Saturday for many years, and most of those years I'll have been here. So it's good to be back in the room, and it's good to see some people that I've known over those years. It's good to see those people again, but it's also very good to see people who I've not seen before. I've not come to the centre regularly over the last year or so, and in a way, if I came along and it was all exactly the same people, there'd probably be something a little bit wrong. There'd be not a sense of refreshment coming into the centre. So it's very good to see new life dawning here at the Buddhist Centre. So welcome if you're fairly new, and I'm going to be speaking as part of this series that's been happening here about the stages of the Sevenfold Puja. Now, I don't know how many of you have been coming to that series, or how many of you really know very much about what we mean by the term Sevenfold Puja. I'm not going to say loads and loads by way of introduction to that. I'm going to get more onto the main topic, which is the sixth section of the puja called Entreaty and Supplication. But I will say, just for the benefit of those who don't know, that the Sevenfold Puja is a devotional ritual, and that devotion forms a very important part of Buddhism, or takes a very important place within the Buddhist tradition. And I think that can often get overlooked. And I wonder a little bit if it gets a bit more overlooked in the Truvatana Buddhist movement these days than it did when I first came along. It's always a little bit hard to compare things. I mean, I first came along to classes here 26 or so years ago, and I think very soon I became quite familiar with devotional ritual. I remember early on we had a festival in London, and Sangharakshita, our founder, was speaking, and he gave a great talk. His talk was called The Buddha's Victory, and I always found it kind of interesting that my name, Dharma Vijaya, has the word Vijaya meaning victory in it. And I was like, that's interesting. That was the first thing I ever heard Sangharakshita talk about was victory, and that ended up in my name. But I'm mentioning this simply because at that festival, that was my first experience of puja, and I loved it. I came on courses and retreats at Rivendell and was soon doing pujas quite regularly. I think they happened every week in those days. But I wonder now if it's possible for people to come along and learn meditation, have discussions about various aspects of Buddhism, maybe want to get quite involved, and possibly even ask to become what we call a mitra and have their mitra ceremony, and then at that point learn it's going to take place within a sevenfold puja. And then someone's wondering, oh, I haven't done one of those before. I wonder if that's possible these days. And it seems a shame to me if it is, because devotion is a sort of indispensable part of Buddhist practice. So I'm very glad that this series is happening, and it's been happening for a while, and is focusing people's attention on devotion and on the Sevenfold Puja in particular. I'm going to be talking about the sixth section of it, which is the stage called Entreaty and Supplication. And the way I'm going to talk about it is just through going through the words of the puja. And not necessarily just saying what they mean, but also sharing various thoughts and reflections that come to mind when I think about these words. And in that way, I hope to convey something of the mood that's trying to be evoked by this stage. And I'll start actually by just reading out the whole stage, just to familiarise ourselves with the stage of the puja as a whole. So it goes like this. Saluting them with folded hands, I entreat the Buddhas in all the quarters. May they make shine the lamp of the Dharma. for those wandering in the suffering of delusion. With hands folded in reverence, I implore the conquerors desiring to enter Nirvana. May they remain here for endless ages, so that life in this world does not grow dark. Okay, so that's the two verses of entreaty and supplication. Perhaps start first of all with those words, actually, the words entreaty and supplication. They're not words that are in common parlance these days, I think. They sound perhaps a bit antiquated, perhaps a bit religious, so to speak. Entreaty, what does it mean? Well, the dictionary says it means an earnest or humble request. Yeah? An earnest or humble request. As used in the sentence, the king turned a deaf ear to his entreaties. A bunch of synonyms, words that mean the same as entreaty, are the following. It means a plea, an appeal, a request, a petition, a cry from the heart. I quite like that one. A suit. Not like a suit. You know, a suit as in a suitor. I can't use the expression. But you know what I mean, don't you? An application. A claim. Beseeching. Pleading. Begging. Solicitation. Importuning. Supplication is a synonym itself for entreaty. Bidding. Exhortation. And so on. Yeah. So, hope it's giving you some flavour of what the word means. The words say, of course, saluting them with folded hands. So there's a gesture to accompany it, the gesture of folded hands. So you're sort of making an earnest or humble request with folded hands. So there's that physical expression. I don't know what it says to you, but to me, it's quite passionate. It's begging, it's pleading, it's a beseechment of somebody or some people to do something. We'll be onto that in a moment. So that's what entreaty means. Supplication means exactly the same. Yeah? So you may wonder why there's two words in the title rather than, you know, just supplication or just entreaty. I don't know exactly why this is, but I do know that in the Christian tradition, there's different kinds of prayer are described. There's petitionary prayer, where you're asking for something for yourself, and there's supplicatory prayer, where you're asking for something for other people. Yeah. Which of those applies to the entreaty and supplication most fully? Perhaps we'll see as we go through. But it's quite a passionate expression. Yeah. We're passionately pleading with somebody to give us or somebody else something. So who are we entreating? Yeah, second line here. I entreat the Buddhas in all the quarters. Yeah? The Buddhas in all the quarters. Now, again, not knowing necessarily how familiar you are with Buddhism, this might be a bit confusing to some people. You might at least know of the Buddha, but you might have a question in your mind as to who the Buddhas in all the quarters are. Yeah? You might also not even be entirely clear in your mind exactly, you know, what a Buddha is, or who the Buddha is. And on the one hand, you probably are familiar with the fact of the Buddha being a starting life as a historical being, you know, 2,500 years ago, etc., who gained enlightenment. This character who was known as Siddhartha Gautama. You're probably familiar with that Buddha. But you might also have the idea in your mind that the Buddha simply means an enlightened being. Yeah. So from that point of view, you could say, well, anyone who gains enlightenment is a Buddha. And that would be valid to say, up to a point. Yeah, up to a point. Because you'd almost have to make a distinction between a Buddha, as it were, with a small b, meaning just an enlightened being, perhaps who's become enlightened through following the teachings of the Buddha, with a capital B. And that Buddha with a capital B would specifically mean a being who discovers enlightenment, who wakes up to reality without guidance, without the guidance of another Buddha. In other words, somebody who discovers the truth about the universe for themselves when it's been completely forgotten or never discovered before in the universe. That's the specific meaning of the Buddha in its full sense, what I'm calling Buddha with a capital B. So we can see that there's a plurality of Buddhas with a small b, beings who've gained enlightenment, but you might think, well, there's only one Buddha with a capital B, the historical Buddha. So what's going on here then in the puja when we say we entreat the Buddhas in all the quarters? I think it's talking about Buddhas with a capital B. So I think we need to kind of enlarge our perspective to see what's being got at here. Yeah? We need to perhaps think about where these other Buddhas could be. Whereabouts could they be if we're not talking about the historical Buddha here on Earth? Where in the universe can these Buddhas be? And perhaps to consider that question, we'd have to first of all think about, well, where in the universe, other than Earth, do we find living beings? I want to start with that question. Where do we find life in the universe other than on Earth? Do we find life in the universe other than on Earth? I think this is an important question because Buddhas begin life as human beings. Yeah? They begin life as ordinary living beings who, by virtue of their efforts, become Buddhas. So if we're going to look for Buddhas elsewhere in the universe, we need to be looking for living beings elsewhere in the universe. As a famous Buddhist sage once said, it is like water and ice. Outside of water, no ice. Outside of living beings, no Buddhas. So we need to consider the question, is there life in the universe beyond Earth? And to approach that, I just want to get a sense of, well, the size of the universe. Yeah? And as I was thinking about this, I started to look up the NASA website. I wanted to learn a bit. Yeah, I think I Googled, how big is the universe? You know, expecting a simple answer to come back. Yeah, it's sort of 50 miles long or something like that. But what it told me was that, the universe apparently is expanding, so you can't fully say how big it is. You can have some knowledge of what's known as the observable universe, yeah? The bits that we can detect, and I presume we detect this by our sensitivity to light and by the sensitivity to light of the most powerful telescopes that there are. And of course they're radio telescopes, aren't they? So it's more complex than I understand. But nonetheless, according to NASA, from here to the boundaries of the observable universe, I think it was 13.8 billion light years. Yeah. So a light year is the distance that light, which travels very fast, I gather, can travel in a year. Yeah. So this means the edges of the observable universe, what we're seeing something that actually happened 13.8 billion years ago. I think this is a US billion, given that it was the NASA website, so it's 1,000 million rather than 1,000,000,000. Yeah, but it's still a lot. So if you were to convert that sort of distance into physical distance that we're more familiar with, apparently it's something like 280 sextillion kilometres, which I think is 280 with 21 zeros after it. Yeah, that's the observable universe. You get the idea. The universe is quite big. And somebody on the NASA website was considering how many planets there were in the universe. And they were sort of saying, presuming that the number of planets in our solar system isn't completely out of the norm, working upon that as a hypothesis, then there are as many, well, how did they put it? They said the number of planets in the universe is greater than the sum of every sound and every word uttered by every human being that's ever lived. Yeah, that's saying that that's how many planets there are in the universe. And it concluded by saying, you know, it would be rather egocentric of us to imagine that, you know, we were the only life in the universe. You know? Of course, human beings are very, very egocentric. For a long time, of course, we were egocentric enough to believe that the planet Earth was the centre of probably what we thought was the universe, certainly what we thought of, well, we didn't think of it as the solar system, did we? We just thought it was the universe, and Earth was the centre of it, and the sun and the moon, well, the sun revolved around the Earth, until this chap Copernicus turned up and said, you could think about it a different way. You know, it could be that we're revolving around the sun. Of course, people were horrified by this and rejected it for a long time. In the same way, we might reject the idea of there being life on other planets from the same sort of egocentrism. But I think safely we can assume that there will be life elsewhere in the universe. Yeah? Life from which perhaps Buddhas could emerge, remembering that's why I'm talking about this. But what would that life be like? Would that life be recognisable as human? I think if you watched Star Trek or Hollywood science fiction films, you'd get the impression that throughout the universe there's all sorts of aliens who, funnily enough, are sort of vaguely humanoid. You know, they're basically humanoid, but maybe with pointy ears or a kind of furrowed brow or an extra eye or something like this, yeah? This is really unlikely to be the case, isn't it, when you think about it? If you look at all the different creatures that live on planet Earth, if you were an alien and you arrived on Earth and you went to a zoo, or if you watched a David Attenborough documentary and you saw all the different kinds of beings that there are, you'd probably be a bit surprised to think they all came from the same planet. If you compare marsupials with insects or something, you know, you've got such an incredible variety of life taking incredibly different forms. This would surely be the case if you extended your view around the whole universe. So we can't really imagine necessarily what physical forms this life might take. I was thinking as well that it may be that there could be life that could be detected by senses that we don't have. You know, we can see, hear, smell, taste and touch things, and those become our physical world. But who's to say there aren't other senses that we don't have, and which other beings do have and could be detected by? So that's just a thought to conjure with, really. You know, different creatures, even on Earth, experiencing the world in very different ways. Bats' perception of things is very different to our own. It's hard for us even to imagine that. So what kind of life is out there? Is it human? Yeah? Is there possibly human life out there if we take the idea that Buddhas emerge from human beings? I think it depends on our not necessarily thinking of it being our physical form that defines us as human. It's not necessarily that we are humanoid that makes us human. I think it's much better to think of it as our humanity being defined by the quality of our mind, our awareness, our consciousness. Yeah. So, you probably weren't expecting this at the beginning, and raising all these big questions. You know, the big questions raised here is, what is consciousness? That perhaps is the biggest philosophical question there is, so I'm not going to go into that. I'm just going to use the term in a fairly everyday sense. You know, we talk about being aware of something. You know, I'm aware of you, you're in my consciousness. I'm not aware of what's going on in a particular side street in Nottingham. I'm not conscious of that, yeah? So consciousness is that act of being aware of something. I'm using the term in a very everyday sense. But you can define beings, you could class different kinds of being according to the things that they're aware of, the objects of their consciousness. This is what Sangharakshita has done when he's looked at consciousness and observed four categories, different kinds of being, according to what they're aware of. Yeah, what is the object of their consciousness? The first category is those beings who are aware of their sense objects. They're aware of what they perceive through their senses. Yeah, that's one category. Another category is beings who not only are aware of what they perceive through their senses, they're also aware that they are there being aware of what they perceive through their senses. So they're sort of aware of themselves perceiving. Yeah? You could call this, if the first class was called sense awareness, this second class is called, you call it self-awareness or reflexive awareness, where your awareness sort of reflexes back on itself and you're aware of yourself experiencing. Beyond that, there could be a level of awareness that Sangharakshita describes as transcendental awareness. And this would be where those beings who are aware of themselves experiencing things become aware that the self experiencing things doesn't have any final and absolute being. It is relatively insubstantial. Thereby, their awareness extends beyond just self-awareness and perhaps experiences the experience of other as much as they'd experience the experience of self. Yeah? A fourth class of aware beings could be those who experience, how to put it, absolute reality, truth. That could be the object of their awareness. Yeah? So there could be four categories of conscious being. Yeah. And we could define the beings that live within those categories with different labels. We could call those who have simple sense awareness, we could say that's what defines the animal, so to speak. We could say that the being who has self-awareness, is aware of themselves sensing, that could be characteristic of what we could call the human being. The being who is aware of the relative and relatively insubstantial nature of the self-experiencing the world, we could describe as being perhaps a transcendental being, yeah? an enlightening being, and a being who is aware of absolute reality itself, beyond words, beyond thoughts. We could say, well, that is a Buddha. So, coming back to my question, is there human life in the universe? It may take all sorts of different physical forms, but I think we could assume that there would be beings of different degrees of awareness throughout the universe. And these different degrees of awareness, I think we can see them hierarchically. You know, put it this way, those with self-consciousness have a greater degree of awareness than those with sense consciousness. Those with transcendental awareness have a greater degree of awareness than those just with self-consciousness, and so on. So there's a sort of hierarchy of levels of being and awareness. But the boundaries between those different levels are not hard defined lines. Yeah? We've sort of divided it up into four just as a way of observing it. In reality, there's a spectrum of degrees of development of awareness. And there is traffic, you could say, between those different levels of awareness. We know this in our own experience. Sometimes we are more or less like animals. You know, sometimes we are just aware of our senses and nothing more. At other times, we're more acutely aware of ourselves experiencing things. And sometimes we may even have an experience of where our awareness broadens out from ourself and starts to experience others in the same way as we would experience ourselves. We start to not so much define ourselves within the confines of our sort of ego personality. Yeah. So even in our own lives, we can find traffic between, or we travel between these different levels of awareness. So as I was thinking about all this, as you can see, I was reflecting about all this to try and find out who these Buddhas are in all the quarters. What had occurred to me was that reflections of this kind brought out a certain truth about the universe. And I found myself looking through some old notebooks. There's a very good book on Buddhism called The Survey of Buddhism. Yeah. Actually, I think it's called A Survey of Buddhism, but we in the movement tend to call it The Survey because it's a significant book to us. And many years ago, I read it through and I took notes. Yeah. And I've still got the notes, I'm glad to say. So if you go on a retreat studying this book, A Survey of Buddhism, these retreats tend to be called The Transcendental Principle. Take good notes, because you never know when you might be called upon to give a talk about entreaty and supplication or any other subject. And I found myself looking through it, and the point about the universe that was coming to mind from considering the question of, is there life elsewhere? Are there different levels of life, different levels of consciousness? I found it summed up in the notes that I took on a survey of Buddhism. And I'm just going to read you some of the notes that I took, because I can't really improve on them now. I know it's just reading something out, it's not so engaging, but hopefully it will convey something. So my notes said, the true perspective is to see the arisal of Buddhas within the context of processes timelessly at work in the whole of the cosmos. There is not one Buddha, but many. The truth is that the attainment of enlightenment is a constantly recurring event in the universe, and the appearance of Buddhas is an integral part of the structure and workings of the universe. There have been and will be innumerable Buddhas, and when we entreat them, we are begging them. Oh, this is not my notes at the time. This is what I've added to my notes now because I'm talking about entreating them. When we entreat them, we are begging them to make their presence felt, which they will do according to the law that is the heartbeat of Buddhism. The law that when the conditions for the production of a phenomenon are present, the effect will inevitably follow. When the conditions are there for something to appear, they will inevitably appear. Yeah. So, just to add to that, there's also a quote from Lama Anagarika Govinda, a well-known German Buddhist, making very much the same point. He says, the quality of enlightenment is inherent in the universe, latent in every form of consciousness, and therefore must come to maturity, according to universal law, whenever the conditions are favourable. The human being, perhaps in the sense that I've defined it, you know, the self-aware being, whatever their physical form, is essentially the vehicle for the rediscovery of the universal character of mind or consciousness, which is inconceivable in its true nature. He goes on, when a human being does rediscover the universal character of mind, that's to say, when a Buddha appears, what he rediscovers and re-proclaims is not one way among many, but the very principle according to which development of being and consciousness in any tradition is possible at all. And he states this principle clearly and emphatically, where other religions seem only to have a fragmentary and distorted understanding of it. Yeah. So my contemplations of the size of the universe, the nature and fluidity of consciousness, has led me to uncovering this principle inherent in the universe that supports growth when the conditions are favourable for it. That principle is what's being got at when we call these retreats on the Survey of Buddhism the Transcendental Principle. It's the principle that I think we actually define as, or we describe using the label, the Dharma, yeah, or truth, or reality, or the way things really are. That is the principle according to which Buddhas appear throughout the universe, whenever the conditions are present for them to arise. And when we perform the entreaty and supplication, when we entreat the Buddhas in all the quarters, we are asking that principle to manifest itself. We're asking for the conditions to come together for Buddhas to arise within the universe. So a question then can arise, how can we successfully entreat them? How can we bring that principle into our lives so it has an effect upon us, so it transforms our own consciousness. How do we successfully beseech, entreat the Buddhas? How do we successfully entreat and beseech that Buddha principle, that Dharma principle? Incidentally, when I was thinking about this principle, an analogy came to mind of a lamp and its radiance. Yeah? This is an analogy that in Buddhist tradition is used to describe the depths of meditation and the enlightenment arising from it. But it can also apply to the difference between Buddhas and the reality they wake up to. It can also be used to describe the relationship between Buddhas and the Dharma. Yeah. So if the Buddha is the lamp, the radiance of the lamp you could see as being the Dharma. But it also works the other way around. If the Dharma, this principle, is the lamp, then the Buddhas represent the radiance of their lamp as well, of that lamp as well. Just a reflection that came to mind. But if we want to effectively entreat the Buddhas, if we want that, well, as the lines go on to say, if we want to make shine the lamp of the Dharma, how do we successfully do it? I think the key lies in the very first word of this section, saluting them with folded hands. Yeah? To salute someone means to acknowledge them, acknowledge their presence, acknowledge them and greet them. And when you salute someone, that's what you're doing, isn't it? You're acknowledging them, you're greeting them. Suppose I came to the centre today to give this talk and nobody acknowledged me and greeted me. I'm very glad to say that they did. Suppose they didn't acknowledge and greet me and instead you all, you know, went up to the library and read books or whatever. I wouldn't be able to communicate to you. You wouldn't be able to listen and think about what I was saying. There'd be no meeting. There'd be no communication of anything. Yeah? So in order for us to successfully entreat the Buddhas, in order to make this lamp of the Dharma shine, we need to acknowledge and greet the Buddhas. In other words, we need to welcome the Buddhas. So that's a way of looking at this section of the puja. In this section, we're welcoming them, we're inviting them to teach. Yeah? Not only are we acknowledging them, not only are we acknowledging just their presence, we're acknowledging them as Buddhas. If our entreaty is to be successful, we need to be able to see clearly that they are Buddhas and know what a Buddha is, which hopefully something of what I've been saying so far will be communicating to you. So I'm going to go on now to the... No, I'm not. I'm going to look at the next line. We're asking them to make shine the lamp of the Dharma. And the next line is, for those wandering in the suffering of delusion. Yeah. So this comes back to the question of supplication or entreaty. Are we begging for something for our benefit or for the benefit of others? According to what we're reciting, we're asking them to make shine the lamp of the Dharma for those wandering in the suffering of delusion. So that's us. That's us, and it's everyone else as well. So it is both entreaty and supplication. Yeah. We don't have this higher level of absolute awareness. We don't necessarily, in a sustained way, have this quality of awareness that's transcendental. Yeah. We may have glimpses of it, probably... if we come along here and we get involved in a sort of Dharma life, we will have glimpses of it. But we don't necessarily sustain those glimpses. So we do need help. You know, we do need the lamp of the Dharma to shine as brightly as possible to guide our way. It's not that we're bad. You know, it's not that we don't see truth, we don't see reality because we're essentially wicked or anything like that. It's more that we just don't have the awareness. It's almost like we don't have the senses yet to perceive it. It's like, you know, you wouldn't, if somebody if you spoke to somebody who was blind and you asked them, you know, can you appreciate that sunset, you wouldn't think they were bad or stupid for not seeing it. It's just they haven't got that capacity. We're in a similar sort of position. Yeah, we're in the darkness of unawareness and delusion rather than being sort of fundamentally wrong. And we can change. You know, the darkness of our awareness can be enlightened. It can be opened up to a greater level of awareness than it currently is now. It can eventually be open fully to the light of reality. But in order for it to do so, you know, we need guidance, as I say. Imagine a blind person trying to find north at night. Yeah? And suppose they met somebody who was sighted. Well, they'd be a darn fool not to ask the sighted person to guide them along the way. And if the sighted person did, but the blind person said, well, I think I'll follow my own nose, you know, they probably wouldn't get very far. Yeah? We're in the same sort of relationship to the Dharma, to spiritual truths, to Dharmic truths. We do need guidance, and we need to acknowledge and welcome that guidance and to follow it when it's present. If not, we won't get very far. I'll move on to the second verse, which I'll deal with more briefly, because it runs together more as a whole. Yeah. So on to the second verse. With hands folded in reverence. Yeah? Again, hands folded, with entreating, we're begging again. And we have reverence. Yeah? Reverence is a fundamental Buddhist attitude or virtue. So fundamental that when the Buddha gained enlightenment, and when he realized that there was no one else at that point who had a greater understanding of reality than he did, there was a side of him which was, we're told, sad. Yeah? Because it was so much in his nature, so much in the nature of an enlightened being, to revere something that you know, he was at a loss, didn't know what to revere, knowing that there was nobody, as it were, above him or beyond him. So then it occurred to him that what he would revere was the truth he had discovered. He would revere the Dharma. But it does illustrate that reverence, this sense of looking up to something that we want to move towards, is fundamental to the Dharma life. So with hands folded in reverence, I implore the conquerors desiring to enter Nirvana. May they remain here for endless ages. Well, the conquerors, that's an epithet for the Buddhas. It's the same Buddhas in all the quarters. Apparently in early Buddhism, the term Buddha was used sometimes to describe the Buddha, but another term was used, I'm told, maybe almost as often, and that was the term Jinnas, yeah? Meaning the victorious ones. Yeah. Or the conquerors, it means the same. So, I implore the conquerors desiring to enter Nirvana, may they remain here for endless ages, so that life in this world does not grow dark. Now, when I read this recently, brought to mind, I don't know if it's brought this to mind for anyone else, another Buddhist teaching, a particular Buddhist discourse. And this is the discourse in the Pali Canon called the Mahaparinibbana Sutta. And that means the discourse of the great passing into final Nirvana. Nirvana, you know, we think of that as enlightenment, isn't it? So, the discourse of the great discourse on the final passing into ultimate Nirvana is a text that tells us about the last days of the Buddha. Yeah? Tells us about the 80-year-old Buddha as he was reaching the end of his worldly life. And during the end of his worldly life, he decides to undertake a sort of grand tour. He's not very well, he's 80, and he describes his body as being like an old cart held together with sort of bits of string and so on. But nonetheless, he wants to sort of say goodbye to all his disciples. So he sets out with his faithful companion, Ananda, his companion and attendant, who loved and appreciated the Buddha very, very deeply, on this final tour to say goodbye. And It's a long text. It's in what's called the section of the long discourses of the Buddha. And I'm only going to dwell on one part of it, and that's that there are three episodes during that grand tour where the Buddha turns to Ananda and he says something. And I thought I'd find the actual words so that I don't just paraphrase it wrong. The three different places the Buddha and Ananda have stopped. Maybe they're admiring the beauty of the scene. They're just conversing, you could say. And at a certain point, the Buddha says to Ananda, "Whosoever, Ananda, has developed practice, employed, strengthened, maintained, scrutinized, and brought to perfection the constituents of psychic power." Yeah. So, you know, whoever has meditated really profoundly, whoever has explored meditation as far as it could possibly go, that's to say, whoever is fully enlightened, could, if he so desired, remain throughout a world period or until the end of it. Yeah. So they could stay alive through those powers in meditation till the end of a world period. So that's, to all intents and purposes, that's till the end of the world. So a person who's developed all those powers in meditation, who is enlightened, could, if so desired, remain throughout a world period or until the end of it. The Tathagata, Ananda — the Tathagata's another word for the Buddha, i.e., in this case, the Buddha saying, me — the Tathagata, Ananda, has done so. He's developed all those powers in meditation. Therefore, the Tathagata could, if he so desired, remain throughout a world period or until the end of it. Okay? So, what he's saying is, I've developed psychic powers so strong in meditation that if I wanted to, through those powers, I could live until the world comes to an end. And each time he says this, you know, what does Ananda say? You know, you'd expect him to say, well, why don't you then? Yeah. Or please do. Yeah. And also, you know, he loves the Buddha very much. But each time that the Buddha says these words, in these three different places, we're told it's that Ananda is as though influenced by Mara. Mara is a sort of a personification of evil in Buddhist texts. And under the influence of Mara, you know, we could say actually under the cloudedness of his own mind, he was unable to grasp the plain suggestion, the significant prompting. Yeah. So this happens three different places on this journey, and each time the response is the same. So it comes to a point where the Buddha says, you know, comes to a point where he renounces, as the text says, his life force, and he resolves that he is coming to the end of his life. And after having made this decision, again as the text puts it, he speaks to Ananda and says, you know, I've given up the life force. I'm going to die. In 3 months from now, I will pass away. And Ananda at this point does respond in a different way. Ananda responds to this news by saying, "May the Blessed One remain, O Lord, for the welfare and happiness of the multitude, out of compassion for the world, for the benefit, well-being, and happiness of gods and men." The Buddha, what does he say at this point? He says, "It's too late, basically, you know." So, you know, do you remember when we were here and I told you this? Do you remember when I was there and I told you this? Do you remember that third place I told you this? And each time, you know, you said nothing. So he concludes by telling Ananda, he said, you know, it's too late now. The fault is yours. Herein you have failed. Since you didn't grasp the plain suggestion, the significant prompting, if you had done so twice, I might have declined, but the third time, I would have consented. Yeah. So there's lots of threes in this whole text, isn't there? There's three places where the Buddha makes this statement, and three places where Ananda misses the point. Yeah. And then when Anada does wake up to it, he's reminded of those three places, and he's told that if he'd asked three times, his wish would have been granted, so to speak. So all this threes, it tells us that the text is, it's not so much a literal text, it's a sort of dramatic text, a sort of dramatic storytelling to make a particular point. And the particular point is that we would gain so much more if our minds weren't clouded by Mara, if our minds weren't clouded perhaps by our own self-preoccupation and so on. If we were fully open to what was before us, we would be able to take in what's before us more and more fully. So this is what entreaty and supplication is all about. It's all about placing ourselves in a position where we're not so much like Ananda. Ananda, I think, is a very interesting character in the Buddhist texts, because we're told that he's, amongst the Buddha's disciples, he stands out as one who's not yet enlightened. He also stands out for his emotionality, actually, and his love of the Buddha. When the Buddha dies, you know, Ananda's distraught. The fully enlightened disciples, you know, carry on quite stoically, so to speak. They don't cry at all. Neither do the cats. But Ananda is inconsolable. Yeah. And I think Ananda stands in these texts dramatically as a sort of Buddhist everyman. He stands in for us, you know. He's very like us. You know, we might have a feeling for the Buddha. We might even love the Buddha, be devoted to him. But do we make ourselves really as open as we could to receive his teachings and put them into practice? Yeah. Do our minds get clouded? Do we turn away from it? At one point in this episode, the Buddha asks Ananda, you know, when I told you that I could have lived to the end of the eon, do you remember me saying that? Do you believe it? He says, yes, I did believe it. And we're again like that. We might hear the Dharma. Not necessarily the thing about the Buddha living to the end of an eon, but we may hear the truths of the Dharma, and we may say, yes, I believe that. You know, I believe that's true. But do we really let it into our lives? Are we really open to it entering into our lives? You could say, more often than not, we take it in, but we don't take it on. So we don't fully take it on in the sense that we would then act upon it. You could say we at our best we're very devoted, but we're not always so committed. You know, we might have, as I say, a strong devotional feeling for the Buddha, but whether that translates into really making the use of this life to realise it as best we can, that's another question. You could say, you know, in the language of Triyatna and Sangharakshita, our going for refuge is provisional and effective, but it's not necessarily real because we're not open enough to it. We don't welcome it enough. So, when we perform the puja, and when we come to this section, which is just before the Heart Sutra or any chosen Dharma reading, it's there because we've thoroughly prepared ourselves in all other ways. You know, we've shown our devotion, we've made offerings to the Buddha, we've intended to commit ourselves to him, we've made plain all the ways in which we fall back from that commitment, we've confessed those. We've rejoiced in the wonderful qualities of developing beings in the universe. We're in a heightened stage of love and positivity. But we're still to hear the truth. And in order to hear that truth, we need something extra. And that's to make ourselves really open to it. Yeah? It's not that the Buddhas need this. We're not doing it for their benefit. Yeah? It's not like the Buddhas really are saying, you know, if you don't ask for it, I'm not going to give it to you. It's not like that. The Buddhas are, it's their nature to be continually communicating enlightenment. In the White Lotus Sutra, there's a parable called the parable of the rain cloud. And the Buddhas are said to be like the rain clouds, just pouring the rain of the Dharma copiously on the world forever. But we don't necessarily collect the water. It can sometimes just sort of run away into the gutters. So when we are saying, when we entreat and supplicate the Buddhas, we're laying out containers to receive the rain of the Dharma. And if we're truly open to it, then we will receive it, and we'll receive benefits of the Dharma for ourselves and for others beyond our wildest dreams. Which is what I wanted to say.